Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Thanks for tuning in to another episode. And before we get started, did you know that you could be watching this conversation right now if you have DirecTV or if you go to our website at offcamera.com? I'm just saying this because a lot of people don't even know that we're also a television show. And I think that there's different ways to enjoy Off Camera. I love podcasts and I love radio. So it's great to be able to take the show in your car or on your run, or if you're ironing, or any of the other ways that we've heard that people are listening to this show. But if you haven't experienced it on television, it's really quite a different experience because you can see these thoughts forming as we talk to different guests on our show. So I encourage you to check it out if you haven't yet. It's a way to enjoy Off Camera even more. And now let's get on with the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Imogen Poots. At just 27, Imogen Poots is one of the oldest souls I've ever met. Maybe it's because she started learning her craft so early, but I suspect she was just born that way. Shortly after being cast in several period films in her native London, she moved to New York to expand her artistic opportunities and was almost immediately offered a string of wildly diverse roles by some of the most respected directors in the business. Beautiful and talented, she could have easily been on her way down a successful, if typical, Hollywood path. But with a wisdom beyond her years, Poots set her own rules for judging her success. That's one reason she's taken a rare step away from film to take on Cameron Crowe's new Showtime series, Roadies. She says it's just the kind of character she loves playing. Not always likable, a little out of step, and above all, not defined by a relationship to a man. The bonus? Totally geeking out about music. In this episode, she talks about her experiences working with wildly different directors, such as Terrence Malick, Peter Bogdanovich, and Cameron Crowe. She also explains why she actually loves the uncertainty that comes with her chosen career. We also get into Paul Simon, bicycle safety, and gardening, Voltaire style. Trust me, it's a wild ride. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Imogen.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
No, I'm so happy to be here because obviously we have a mutual connection.
We do. We have the Cameron Crowe connection.
The Cameron Crowe connection. But no, this is awesome. I'm so, so happy to be here to shoot the breeze.
Well, speaking of shooting the breeze, I just found out that you live in Venice.
Yes, I'm here in Venice, off of a walk street.
Oh, yes.
And I have a beach cruiser bicycle, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's got very wide handlebars.
Have you hit anyone yet?
No, I haven't. I've actually been going on the roads. I've been weathering the storm. But it's odd because I don't think people take you as seriously when you're on a beach cruiser as compared to a normal bicycle.
Like if you had the cycling shorts and the jersey.
Yeah. And I think you're just riding too low.
Yeah.
They just choose not to see you. No, it's actually so pleasant. It's just a childish wonder when you get back on your bicycle again and you feel so free and unfettered and you can just ride the universe.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah.
So you have this amazing body of work for how old you are. It's like you have the body of work of a 40-year-old woman.
Just not the wisdom. Well, no, it's interesting. I guess I started when I was about 16, and something strange happens, doesn't it, with time, where obviously everyone always says it goes faster and faster, but these capsules of time, and it's almost secular in a sense of how you start to look back on the past, and nostalgia seems to happen in different episodes of time. And so it's quite surreal now when I think about starting out when I was about 17 years old,
yeah,
16 in London, and also what the notion of like America was and American film and how that whole system seemed to operate. And then flash forward to being able to live in New York is completely ludicrous.
Does it feel weird that you can do that? I mean,
yeah,
I guess I would look at it and go, when you start that young, I'm sure it all seems like a lark and time's flying and everything. But at some point, there must be some feeling of the obligation or responsibility of success.
Sure, and I suppose as well, when I started out doing it, it was purely just because I really loved it and it was necessary. It became essential to do it. And the plus side was that you could do it professionally. And I was given that opportunity and followed that through. But it's very strange because the success of it is something which is so external and seems to me to be decided by everyone else. And I think there's a really great playwright called Young Jean Lee. And in one of her plays called The Appeal, this character Wordsworth says, "Why can you never feel your own luck?" And I think that's such an interesting idea as to why you never really know when it's good. I mean, you have fleeting moments when you're like, oh, this feels terrific and this feels grounded and real. But it seems to me in hindsight, you can only really assess.
You know, that's so funny because I think you can go through life missing your own best moments.
It's true, it's true. And it's difficult. You have to decide where you're going to find happiness, whatever that means, and really kind of consider that it's not just one thing. And especially with this industry, with what you do and what I do, you're completely spoilt at times with the fact that you get to meet a certain amount of people per day and learn about different experiences every single hour. It's such a kind of shock to the system, really, when you realize how your life could be linear, perhaps, in a different way.
Absolutely.
But it's funny, isn't it, too, because you also can be so hard on yourself at times, which I think is actually extremely important to keep going with anything anyone does in life. And I do think no one has an ordinary life, an ordinary existence as such.
But it is true. If you recounted your last year to somebody, most people would be like, that's crazy.
Yeah. I hope it always remains completely absurd, because the sense of the absurd is what seems to keep all of us sane.
I read a quote from, maybe it was The Independent, when you were like 17 years old, and you said the reason you like acting is because no one knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
There was this idea that fate was going to sort of decide your path. And to me, I think like, okay, that's a 17-year-old talking, but...
Yeah, bullshit.
But if you can handle that kind of uncertainty in your life, if you're someone who actually thrives off uncertainty...
Sometimes. And don't you find too, I mean, it must have been the same when you were that age, how you think about life in the sense of these chapters, these kind of endless chapters in front of you, and then suddenly you're in the midst of them. And your taste has changed in the last decade drastically, and how you define happiness has changed, and all these different priorities have kind of been reassembled. And you just transform so very much, as you should hopefully, to be a functioning human being. But something about the uncertainty of it is always attractive, probably just by being quite a restless person at heart and wanting to travel and have that opportunity to see the world. But also the unknowable nature of human beings. That's why I thought about it a lot. And I think that's why acting can be such an amazing vocation, because we're all unknowable. You never really know the truth behind somebody's eyes.
It's true.
And
it's,
that kind of is extraordinary when you think about that.
Well, tell me, like, when you were a kid, were you an extroverted, like, wild, creative?
It's funny because people often say, you know, oh, were you bullied at school? And I've always just been like, no. And as time's gone on, I've kind of thought, I mean, I don't think I was bullied, because I was so oblivious, I think, a lot of the time. I was also brought up in a way where the sense of play was really important, which is like the greatest gift you can give to a kid, is to kind of say, use this.
Because your parents encouraged that, like
imagination.
You had a creative household. And
yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think I kind of, the idea of boredom to me doesn't really, I understand what it is, but it's something which doesn't have a great weight ever in my life, because there's so many things you could be doing and thinking about and creating. But I remember very clearly, and it's something which, as time's gone on, it's become more vivid, was this memory that in school, I would always ask to go to the bathroom, and then I would go and sit in the cubicle, and I would talk to my watch.
What?
possibly that was early
signs. The stall, you're sitting in the stall.
Yeah, just sitting there.
Talking to your watch.
For a good long time, like a good...
Who are you talking to?
That's just myself, hence slightly concerned about impending insanity, early stages.
But looking at that, do you think you had just such a rich imagination that you'd rather have that time for your own company than...
Sometimes. Yeah. I would definitely say there are a lot of people I would love to hang out with, but I'm also very, very comfortable just doing my own thing. And imagination is... It's what we all have at our fingertips, and it's quite extraordinary to transcend the kind of chaos of like this life. Is and it's also crazy, isn't it, too, because you can fabricate scenarios which are entirely terrifying.
I feel like if you're allowed to be original from a young age, then maybe you are a little more oblivious to whatever other...
I think so. And it's always hard to say, but it's just interesting. And I think that's why, like, going to see theatre. I saw a reading of a Kenneth Lonergan play in New York, and Adam Driver was doing it. And it was just a bare stage, and it was just him reading at a stand with some other actors. And it's just that the purity of that is so exciting, because your imagination does everything else. And it's also because of the talent of the speakers in front of you, but that combination, that's heaven. And something that I've found really interesting as time has gone on is, isn't it insane when someone takes you seriously? The first moment that happens, it's shocking.
Do you remember that moment for you?
Yes. I mean, I remember for a while certainly feeling, okay, I'm doing this, and you're still a kid, and you're delegated to kind of being a kid because people treat you that way. As of the age you are. And I think something happened. It was one of my favorite jobs I've ever done in my life, called a late quartet.
Oh, yeah.
And being taken seriously by this trio of actors. I mean, it's almost like a dream, but it's Christopher Walken, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Catherine Keener. And to be in the company of those artists, and to have someone ask you what you think and sort of challenge you was just bewildering and blisteringly exciting. I mean, it was just such a crazy experience, but it's wild when that first happens.
You didn't go to acting school, right? You didn't.
No.
So how did you find it? I mean, how did you sort of discover that this is what you do, or how did you have that first experience where you were drawn to the stage or to acting? Or
I think. There was a theatre group that I used to go to when I was about 15, mm-hmm. and it was run by guys and girls in their late 20s, which is wild because at the time I was like, wow, they're so old and like refined and sophisticated, but they were just kids. And it was all of this material that we would write ourselves and then put on. And I remember playing sort of characters that were the antithesis to the age I was or anything like that. It was always like old women or like dirty old men, and just like really bizarre casting choices. But it was just the magic of that, and being in a theatre when the play is just about to start and the lights go down, or a concert, the same thing. That's when you remember everything is in the right place, you know, that's such an extraordinary place to be.
So it didn't scare you?
No.
Like it felt like that's where you should be.
Yes, and I think it's terrifying, obviously, at the same time, but there's something very reckless, isn't there, about this job, too, where it's a chance to live something out. And it just, for me, isn't one simple thing.
You know, you mentioned working with some of the greatest actors, and Christopher Walken, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Catherine Keener, and you're so young. Was there a moment when you said to yourself, the way I'm getting there is just as valid as the way these people are? Or were you just tremendously overwhelmed with the amount of experience in the room? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's the validation is something which certainly takes a while. And I hope it never fully forms, because that keeps you it keeps some sense of fear in you, which is so important. But I remember, for example, with that job, I was extremely aware of how just crazy that opportunity was. And it was really more of, I am a sponge, but at the same time, I'll try and hide that from you three because you're just, you want someone to kind of go head to head with you in the best way possible. But no, that was a fully kind of, I certainly didn't get to work each morning and be like, I definitely have a right to be here at all. I was right. Just sort of like, wow, this is extraordinary.
Well, how do you do that? Not have that lock you up, like in terms of your confidence?
Yeah. I suppose that's also credit to those actors being so generous. And I mean that like fully naked for you and fully available. And I remember the first time, I remember when Catherine Keener walked into the rehearsal room, and she was like galvanizing. I mean, just like she stunned you with her electricity. She's just this wild, beautiful woman and actress. And there's something about that which kind of sets you free.
It's oh, like, yeah?
Yeah, 100%. Because you have to speak up and you have to play. They're there to play, and that's kind of exhilarating.
Yeah, I would think you could go one of two ways. You could step up and play, or you could crumble. Yeah. And I guess maybe there's your test right there.
Yeah. And there's also something which obviously with time, you do grow more confident. And you grow more confident in your convictions and your choices. And perhaps additionally, you just grow very savvy.
Does that happen quick?
It took me a while. It took me a second for sure. I think there was a period of time where you're working and first of all, you get an audition. And then you manage to obtain a role, and then you go on to the job, and you're sort of thinking, well, I'm just lucky. I'm lucky to be working. This is crazy. I know so many actors who can't even get an audition, or people who all over America and all over Europe who are still there and are in those cities, in the theatre houses of the playhouses of those cities, and they're doing it every single day. But this is sort of a separate planet in a sense of being exposed for this art. I think I started to understand that you're a working actor and that's terrific, but okay, well, it seems to be going good. Can I now start to make the choices that I really am driven by and I'm really excited by and the films that I would want to go and see?
Right, there's this transition that takes place from I'm happy to be here and I'm going to soak everything up to if I want to own this, I'm going to have to like, you have to harness everything that you are inside and use it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
You said something really interesting about how you find a character. I think it was an interview for Knight of Cups. You said that as weird as it sounds, you have to breathe in the character and find the psychology behind her. And to me, I read that and it makes sense and it's mysterious at the same time.
Yeah.
How do you develop something like that or how do you discover that?
Well, it definitely took me time because, again, it's interesting when you're 17, you think it's one thing. You think it's your knowledge of that time and your current state and your identity then. And I think as time rolls on, so for example, I did a Peter Bogdanovich film.
Yes.
And that's essentially academic filmmaking in terms of the beats that you hit. And the scenario itself, and there are certain qualities to making a film of that nature which differ greatly, obviously, to like a Terrence Malick film. And so you start to say to yourself, okay, well, rather than, and this could sound pessimistic, but rather than falling victim to different types of filmmaking, is there something? Is there continuity within your approach? And I think what you have to keep coming back to, and what I'm excited to learn again and again in different ways is it's just about the truth. Whatever's happening in the world, even if aliens right now came down and lifted the ceiling off of this and we were filming right now, like you would just react with truth and that's all we have.
I would try to stay in character.
You would totally stay. Yeah, you would. But it's a crazy thing because then you think about the psychology of a character is, I guess what I was saying earlier about someone being unknowable, and then you're given the keys to someone's psychology, and that's crazy. That's amazing because you get the chance to know someone else.
When you say you're given the keys, you have to discover those.
Yeah.
Like, they may be in there somewhere.
Sure, yeah.
But if you let someone else tell you the keys, like if you let the director or the screenwriter tell you the keys, then you're not really owning it, right? So you have to find the ones that somehow fit with you.
Yes, I think so. And I think, I mean, wow, as time has gone on, filmmakers so, so, so important to the piece because material can be exceptional and other times it can be really disappointing. But it does come down to the person who's essentially putting it together at the end of the day because you're walking away from it. And that's sometimes a really hard thing to do. And so, you start to trust far more your own kind of intuition about a certain project or a character and whether someone's really on the same wavelength as you are.
Right. That's probably even a process to know what to ask or what to get to when you're meeting a director,
yeah,
right? Because you don't
yeah.
want to find that out a third of the way into filming.
No.
Because you gave a great example. The Bogdanovich film, She's Funny That Way.
Yeah.
Is like a Preston Sturges.
Yeah.
Very, you know, there's a rhythm to it. And it's a classic example of you have to commit to the director's vision.
Yeah.
Because there's a hysteria and a physicality there and there's, and you know, if you try to protect yourself too much in that,
yeah.
then you won't match the, like.
But it's, and it's funny because I feel like in hindsight, thinking about that, Preston Sturges, oh my goodness, those films, Palm Beach Story and Sullivan's Travels are.
And Lady Eve.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. But first time I saw them, I was just like, whoa, I'm alive again. But looking at a film like The Shop Around the Corner with James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, and that was going a million miles an hour, and the plot itself was, you know, there was a plot, but it was really just kind of the pathos, and it was really just about these characters. And no matter what was happening, the rhythm and the movement and how kinetic it became, they were still extremely naturalistic. And that's, I mean, that's just kind of the epitome, I suppose, of the essential comic and how they do that. It's just, it's a thrill ride when you see that happen.
Yeah, and you know, you say as an actor, you walk away, and you don't have any control over.
Sure.
You have control over what you have control over.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about having to just put your trust into a filmmaker and
yeah.
how you both stay true to yourself and give yourself over to a director's
yeah.
ideas.
I think in terms of trusting a filmmaker, I personally always find that trust and respect go hand in hand. And the moment either of those things falters, it's very difficult to work with someone or even just be around any human being
sure,
in
sure.
general. But I will say in the last couple of years, I haven't encountered that. I've just encountered wonderful filmmakers. And that was certainly, I think a couple of years ago, I moved to New York and I was like, right, there's a certain type of work I really want to be able to do. I wonder if I can. And sort of went in search of that. And so whether it's Cameron Crowe or Jeremy Saulnier, who helmed Green Room, or Matt Ross, who did this film called Frank and Lola.
Yeah.
There are just these human beings out there who are just fully committed and it's pure. And of course, they're away from the studio system, so there's a blessing that comes with that.
She's Funny That Way is a good example. I also heard that film's title was originally like Squirrels.
Squirrels to the Nuts.
Squirrels
which
to the
makes
nuts.
Perfect sense.
And it seems like it's such a marketing thing to change the title.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Which
absolutely.
Sort of, that's always tough. When you see that a film got a late title change,
yeah.
you know some marketing person got in there and thought they could.
I mean, it's when you hear the story, was it Paul Schrader's last film? Someone went in and they stole his right to the cut or something.
Yeah.
It's just, and Peter Bogdanovich, I mean, just let them do them. I mean, you can't, if Peter Bogdanovich is going to make a film in 2016, just let him do him because he's one of the most prolific, extraordinary, unique filmmakers from the 1970s. And so what if it doesn't meet the criteria of the rom-com that's on it? The local movie theater that everyone
right.
understands and is accessible and there's a formula. Like, don't let don't give Peter Bogdanovich the keys then. I mean, do, but...
I totally agree. You know. It's like if you're going to hire somebody and say, okay, we want you to make your film.
Yeah.
That should be the end of it.
Exactly.
And then you go let them make it. And if it doesn't turn out well, you say, well, next time I won't... I wanted something else, so I won't hire that person.
Yeah, 100%.
I always feel that way. I think that you know, and I'm sure you feel the same way, you can tell when you're in a situation where they didn't hire you for you.
No.
They see you as someone they want to shape you into.
Yes, 100%, 100%. And it starts with bras. It starts with like, okay, so here's your bra. It's like, yeah, but this is really big and there's an issue here.
You know, it doesn't start with bras for me, but
I
see the analogy.
Different story. Yeah.
I think a good example to talk about for that very idea is Green Room.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
Okay, so we should set that up. Green Room is a film that takes place, it's about a punk rock band and they're in a van and they're out of money and they get a gig at like some backwoods Oregon dreary clubhouse thing that turns out to be like a neo-Nazi skinhead camp.
Yes, Whoops.
Yeah. Whoops. And
sort of becomes like a siege movie.
Yes, and something terribly bad happens, and they meet you there, and you know, you're almost unrecognizable. Half your hair is long, and the other side of your head is shaved, and it's incredibly gripping and intense, and hard to watch at times, and very assured filmmaking, but in that genre of we're going to go so dark.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm watching this and I'm going, okay, why did you pick this role? And part of me said, maybe she picked it because it has nothing to do with beauty or vanity or like, and I just wondered if that, you know, if that's a good example of sometimes you have to go completely the other way to get away from that kind of
thing.
That's
a very, very good example. And it's funny because I look at that film and I owe a lot to Jeremy Saulnier, because a lot of directors, and perhaps they're answering to someone, I don't mean God, but I mean someone like a studio or whatever.
Someone up the glass elevator. Yeah,
someone on the cloud. Yeah, yeah. They're answering to someone else about what they should be looking for to cast, and they lack imagination. Whereas Jeremy was, he met me, he Googled and seen some picture of me wearing some dress with some sort of ludicrous hairstyle and probably just thought like, fuck no. But then met me and was like, all right, well, do you want to read? And it's important that those people give actresses opportunities, because you don't go along and start doing theatre group and want to do this because you want to be someone's girlfriend.
Or
it's
you
tricky.
Do, and, it, and it's a completely different
right. Maybe
life
exactly.
That you're
maybe that's your that's what you're looking for. But no, with this with Green Room, it was very it was an amazing experience, and you certainly don't look to employ any sort of vanity in any role.
Right.
And it was dark, and it was one of the best experiences ever making that film. And I think that's because, not only, obviously, as you said, like there are physical changes, like the hair and the clothing, and obviously what happens with the face,
Sharpie.
Facial shitty, Sharpie stuff. But also, I think it was Orson Welles, and he said that it's not just about putting things on you, but it's actually what do you bring out of you. So if we all inherently have that kind of savage primal quality to us, so when you are presented with that kind of insane scenario, what do you do, and what does your kind of survival instinct manipulate you to do and help you navigate how to manage that situation? And so it was exciting to kind of, as that character, test your own like moral sanity and values and all of these things. And I think that's why it was so cool to be there, because it was like endless.
Do you think you're the same kind of actor on a film like that as you are, like say on the Terrence Malick film? Like you said a second ago, the truth of the situation is the governor for what you do.
Yeah.
But I would imagine watching Jeremy versus Terrence Malick versus Peter Bogdanovich, they almost look like different jobs, probably.
100%. I mean, walking onto the Terrence Malick set, you sort of hold that statement close to you somewhere, but at the same time, you don't know what's going to happen and what's going to unravel, and what you're, and also you're there for a reason. It's like you're in a Terrence Malick movie, so you'll do whatever Terrence Malick suggests you do. Otherwise, go home.
Right.
I was fully open for that experience, and it's hard because if someone says to you, "There's a squirrel in a yellow mug," and that's a line that you have to say, it's pretty hard to quickly assemble any sort of conscious consciousness to do with that. You just have to kind of feel it in the moment.
Yeah.
But it's really strange. But I think there's always some continuity with any sort of approach, like working with Cameron as well. You still just want to find reality within any of these people and some sort of grounding. But with a Malick film, as a film goer and as a like student of his films, meaning I love his films, not meaning I've studied under Terrence Malick, you start to adore kind of his exploration of like archetypes and themes and, I mean, his later work. So
ambiguity.
Yes, yes.
And like, so you have to, how much, like, I always, when I watch his films, and Knight of Cups is especially this, I think, is he deliberately trying to see how little he can supply the viewer to still let the viewer get the general feeling he wants to give? I mean, I would assume you didn't get many answers or parameters going on to that.
No, and you could always ask the questions. And I just find him as a filmmaker just extraordinary because I think he presents us with myths, and it's sort of, that in itself is just, I mean, mythology is obviously at the core of many, many different types of genre of film, but especially with Malick, because it's this idea of what something's meant to be. So the myth of love, or the myth of nature, like the pure beauty of nature, and the myth of Los Angeles as a city. Like, what does it mean? Does it mean parties and beautiful women and infinity swimming pools and things like this? But then he subverts these things, and so he gives you the poetry, but you are never fully settled into the beauty of it, even though his cinematographer is like this genius.
Yeah.
You're always slightly on edge because you know there's something darker.
I would imagine you've developed a ritual of prep or a way you do things. Were you able to apply that to going in on this film?
Not so much. I mean, I definitely had a lot of notes, and I definitely... And it was one of those situations where I had written a lot of things and I thought about a lot of things and I was sort of starting to over-prepare. And then I realized the first day I literally just had to be like, and everything had to just disappear off into the ether because there was just no way of knowing what was going to be asked of you next. And perhaps what was going to be asked of you would contradict what you thought this person would say or do.
Does that give you confidence, or like, did you get into the rhythm where I'm okay? Like, I can walk on the set and be open.
I think yes, the latter. I think I just decided just to be open, and that it wasn't going to be a conventional filmmaking process.
Yeah.
And also the knowledge that you probably won't even be in the film, so just have a really great time. And being around him as a human being too was just so groovy. I mean, there's no one like him. And he just puts you at such ease. So you just know that you're in a specific type of filmmaking environment.
You mentioned earlier that you have to sort of push yourself and work hard and take stock of who you are to be able to keep growing.
Yes.
Because I always think about this idea of an actor having a completely different reaction or interpretation of their career than an audience or a critic.
Yeah, I bet.
And I just wonder if you have had experiences on films that maybe didn't connect with an audience or didn't connect with critics, but they were incredibly important to your own growth or your own, like, watershed moments. Is it completely different from the public's?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's a fine line when you have to decide for yourself if you're going to start finding happiness in the wrong places, and if you start to believe that because a film has got good reviews, it's anything to do with you, you got to stop that immediately because it's not that. It's I don't think finding any sort of security or validation through kind of the public opinion, I think that's incredibly dangerous. I think it has to come from you, and you have to know what you love and what's important. As time goes on, I really do recognize that. Just in the sense as well of saying, you know, I mean, look at how many plays were never published or how many films were completely trashed, and yet now they're like heralded as masterpieces. I mean,
right.
And same with musicians. I mean, Love and Mercy, you look at that film and you see how Pet Sounds was completely just dismissed, and yet that Beach Boys album has become
exactly
one of the greatest. I mean, it's just an example like that, but that's completely off the...
No, I hear what you're saying. It's like if you in the short term let someone else decide what's good or bad and not have your own scale.
Yeah, and I think there'll always be so many people who want to dictate that for you, just the nature of this business and decide what you should be doing. And you really... It's also wild, isn't it, too? Because I'm always surprised when people say... Like people say, like, are you having like a really exciting time? Like, are you having great fun? And obviously, you're thrilled to be there, but you're also very conscious of, it should be. I think sometimes things should be difficult. I think it's very disconcerting when things seem to be running so smoothly, and I think that that's something that you carry into work, hopefully.
Yeah, if things are running too smoothly, do you feel like, well, maybe this director isn't challenging me enough, or maybe they don't even have enough grasp over their own material to really push it?
Yeah, and you wonder like, oh, well, have we really kind of understood this, or is this just, are we skimming it? Are we kind of distracted? And that's obviously a silly way to be sometimes as well. But I think that's why you kind of keep going back, is to keep asking more and more questions. And occasionally there are moments of complete ecstasy when you feel like something is kind of pure and real, and you feel that with an actor opposite you, perhaps, or actress opposite you. And I guess the one thing you can have control over is the choice. So the choices that you make. And that's something which now I feel like I just have to... That's just very important to me.
Yeah, because I would assume when you start young, you're just happy to be working.
Absolutely.
And happy to have a job. And at some point, people try to start putting you in a box, right?
Yes, and there's no one to blame. It's your own decision to go and do something or not do something. And so you have to start really paying attention. And I think when you are young, you are happy to be working. And, you know, obviously... You look at some performers and you think, wow, they just work with auteur after auteur and they've just done show after show and it's just incredible. But then it's, you know, it's your own existence and it's your own quest, not to sound insane, but it's your own sort of path that you start to plow. And one of the most valuable things which my brother told me about was Voltaire's Candide and about to cultivate your garden. And obviously that whole story is extraordinary about how you live with choices that you make. But I keep coming back to that. It's about cultivating your garden. That's kind of that's all you can do.
Yeah, well, it is the experience that every artist has at some point where they realize, oh, people want to put you in one lane and tell you what it is you do well.
Yeah.
And if you, God forbid, you have some early success, because those are the only kinds of projects you will see being offered to you. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I look at, I remember being 18 and I remember actresses who, and I just think they're amazing, actresses who became the forefront of a franchise or something, and having someone like Kristen Stewart. I'm in such awe of that girl. I think she's a wonderful actress. I think the choices that she makes are flawless. I think the life she's leading, which must be really nuts, you know. I always consider, wow, to go to sleep one night and wake up and the rest of the world has decided who you are, and you have to get up and meet that person and be that person unconsciously.
Is that kind of a cautionary tale to watch that happen to somebody? and to look at that and sort of digest it in parallel to your own career. And
well, you never imagine, you always think it happens to someone else, whether it's something terrific or something terrible, right? So it's really more just, I pay attention to an actress like that and I just think, wow, I just have a lot of admiration for her. And simultaneously, it must be incredibly tough if something, the exact same thing has happened to someone else who can't move past that because you're a child.
Right.
You don't know.
Right.
You know? And so all of your triumphs or all of your mistakes are made publicly. And especially with like social media now, it's just a frenzy. It's not even kind of word of mouth about like, oh, Marilyn Monroe was it,
yeah.
Whatever. You know, it's like you actually, it's everywhere.
It's well, it's a great idea in theory, but I think social media coming up against cultivating your own garden gets really complicated.
It does, because everyone else has kind of evaluated it.
Everyone's shitting your garden.
Everyone's shitting in your garden, and it sucks. And it's not even good fertilization. It just sucks.
No, and I think that's the thing. I mean, at a certain point, you do become more responsible for your path. And I already look at the choices you're making, and I think I see someone who wants to carve out a path that isn't decided by whoever thinks you're marketable in something.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, I think
that's cool. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe this is a good transition into roadies because up until this point, other than when you were really young, you've done only film, and now you've taken on television.
Yes.
And it's Cameron Crowe's new show on Showtime, and it's called Roadies, and it's basically, it shows the community of people that get a band from city to city and on and off stage every night.
Yeah.
And a world that really hasn't been seen before.
Sure, and it's something which is so, so just entrenched in Cameron's bones. I mean, this is his playground, and the stories that he has and some of the anecdotes he's told us that he's then integrated into the screenplay. It's just so cool. It's pure belief in what's real, and that's music, and that's people who put on the show, and the love of music. And he's so, it must be his kind of journalistic past, but he is just so curious about why people do what they do, right?
Right.
But so to play a role that I personally, I do feel there's some Cameron in her, and I'm really kind of in awe of that side of it. But to do television was it's just such a new ground. It's just such kind of a
wild thing. I would imagine that you would have to love the filmmaker to commit to. Really an open-ended, I mean, the film, okay.
Yeah.
You can get through it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 5 weeks of your life. And,
yes.
And, but this could be three, four,
10
5
million
years.
10 years.
That's right. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Was it hard to sign that deal? Was it hard to like say, okay, or did you look forward to a little bit of like routine?
So, well, there were TV projects in the past and you're told at the time, you know, well, it's going to be a really big success. And you're like, yeah, but it's just not, it's not what I want to do. It's not why I, you know, you're here on Earth for a hot second, so you may as well spend your time doing something that you believe in. And I read this script, and I loved him, and I loved the role. She wasn't inflicted in any way by a male or a device. She was like a real kind of fully fleshed out, independent girl. And I love the world of music because there's an endlessness to that. And I think what's interesting about this and could work for it or against it is the fact that it's just about stuff. It's just about people and day to day. But yeah, there's something very nonchalant and kind of casual about roadies. And some people might think, okay, so when's like, you know,
when's someone gonna commit suicide?
Yeah, exactly. Or like, when's everyone gonna like turn out to be vampires? Because that's what makes sense to us. No, it's just very kind of normal and day to day. And I just think that's kind of cool to create a character in that way.
How do you get to the place where you feel like, oh, I know this world, I know this person? And
well, that's interesting because you are, the only thing you're given is the pilot script. And I really loved that. And then what's hard is you really do have to take a leap of faith because you don't know what's going to happen afterwards and you don't know where it's going to go. That was slightly disconcerting. I had trepidation about the longevity of it, but also about what was going to take place.
Right.
Because what drew me to her, as I said before, was the idea that there was no man. It was her own passions that the pilot explores to do with music and the old way and the new way in film. And you don't want to kind of get to episode 106 and she's like just living in a white picket fence with a goat and a man and sort of washing dishes. So
that's not what happens?
No. Can you imagine if Cameron's just like, yeah, well, we just decided, we just take the easy route. But it was...
we got a goat.
Yeah, she'll still have the do-rag, but yeah. It'll just be different, different job. No, that was terrifying. But I think in terms of understanding her, I think I've met versions of this person before, and they're not comfortable, really, ever.
What do you mean not comfortable?
I think when you meet human beings and they just... There's just something rhythmically wrong with their placement with the rest of humanity. It's just, she's the person who, you know, at a dinner party, her meal never comes. She's just that person. Like, they messed up the order. Or sort of the clock is always just a little bit too far behind, but not far enough behind that you can still get it together. There's just something she just can't really ever win. And I just find that really charming. But at the same time, there's a deep frustration there because maybe she doesn't really like herself that much. None of us do like ourselves very much, but I mean in the sense of how she has to kind of move past that in this familial type setting.
Did you have conversations with Cameron about that level of what, you know, What does he really want out of these characters?
I think he is so, so smart. And I think the smartest people can hide things. And I think Cameron, I want to protect his vision so much. And I know everyone does on this. It's very, very him. And it's very important to him. And there's something about, there's something that's just very easy to talk about and to understand when it comes to him and comes to music, because I think I remember telling him about when I first got The Queen Is Dead, this album by The Smiths.
Yeah.
And I remember very clearly it was in my mum and dad's house in London, and I was meant to go out that weekend or something and put on the CD, and I just sat on the floor of this room in the front of the house, and I just spent hours in there and just listened to this one CD. And I realized, like, oh, this is all you need. This is it. This is incredible. And we spoke about that. And I think he had similar moments too, where you find this treasure chest, and you continue to as you grow older and your taste develops into different types of music and art or whatever. But once you find someone on that level, then you're like, I get you, and we're safe here together, which
right.
Sounds kind of naive. But that's okay, because maybe it is. But he's
Well, that's what you're looking for, I would assume, with every director, with every, you know, every writer, everyone that you're making a piece of art with, is that, am I safe enough to actually be unsafe?
Yeah, and also, I think the thing that I'm really thrilled to see that he also supports is characters do not have to be likable. I don't want to watch people I like all the time. I want to see people that I find despicable and horrendous, because that's real life, and that's also how we endure our own life, because we see something horrifying up on screen or on stage, and we understand kind of how to survive and go through this. And so I think I'm always erring on the side as well of, well, it's okay if at times she's just really wrong and it's okay to see someone really flawed and prickly and gauche, because those are very attractive qualities actually to play.
Right. I mean, that must be exciting, knowing that you can explore that.
I think so. And it's so beautiful to be so honest with someone. Also, I get the impression with a lot of TV shows that people who say they're going to stick around don't stick around. And from day one, Cameron said, I'll be there. I'll be around. And he really has been, despite kind of other directors coming in and out.
Right.
And writers and with their ideas. But he's just fully in. And also to really believe that there's a reason to tell this story. I mean, that in itself is really astounding. To kind of stand up and say, no, there's someone out there, even if it's one person, who, what did he say the other day? There's one person in a record store and they're looking at something and they go, oh, really? And they turn around and they, you know, listen to this TV show or something like that. It feels like if we reach that guy, then we good. And
you
know, I thought, wow, that's pretty cool.
You strike me as not of your generation so much in terms of, I mean, the cliche word is old soul, but you strike me as somebody who, I mean, I think about this. I've my life has straddled the no technology and technology line.
Yeah.
And Cameron's as well. And you know, I think that music meant more in some ways when there was less money, and if you were economically, you know, if you could only buy one album a month
or something,
right?
Yes.
And you've grown up basically in a time where all music's available all the time.
Yeah.
And I wonder from your perspective, because I know how it looks from my perspective, and I can start sounding like the old guy on his lawn, you know. But I wonder from your perspective what that looks like in terms of, I don't know, creating a connection that's real versus one that has a like next to it, or
well, this
something.
Is the thing. I struggle a lot with aspects of this time, implying that I've experienced anything different, which I haven't. But but in terms of social media and things like that, I mean, that's just the invention of the soundbite, which can do incredible things, but also it's, people don't talk about things anymore, and the art of conversation sometimes doesn't really have a place, and that's hard because sometimes you don't know what you think or feel about something until you're talking about it, whereas other times you're just confronted with, this is what's being said, and now it's exploded, and now it's a thing, rather than actually being reductive about it and trying to talk about important things. And learning that way. But it's funny with something like an iPod, because you're right, you don't just have one album, and you don't know that track two after track one, that's the way the album was meant to be, to flow into it, each song that way. And it's crazy that you now will say, oh yeah, well, which Wilco album or which Bowie album is that song from? And someone can't tell you. They're like, oh, I don't know.
Then they have to go, hey, Siri.
Yeah, exactly.
Then they know
then
everything.
Then they have to talk to that
lady. They know
it's
nothing.
Crazy. But it's funny. So have you read any Renata Adler books?
I have not.
Speedboat and Pitch Dark, I think, are the two most well-known. But Speedboat, she speaks about how we forget how to miss things now. Because when you write a letter and you send it off across the ocean and you wonder how that person will be when they read it and receive it and how they'll feel. And it creates this sensation in you. And maybe that doesn't exist anymore. Maybe that, I mean, within, I'm talking about within not a third world country, but within somewhere like where we have access to technology, have we killed that sensation of really missing someone and longing? Because no matter, what if you miss someone so much and you're like, I can always call them, or I can text them and let them know that I still love them or I'm thinking of them. But if you can't do that, that's like, that could crucify you.
And I think Cameron has a way of sort of riding that tightrope in his writing, where it's so close to going too far, but it, like, the idea that if you bury your soul, it will connect with another soul.
Yes. And I think maybe what you were going to say, but I feel this way, is there's a line and it could suddenly become very sentimental, or it could suddenly become ridiculous, but it won't, because it's Cameron and he knows he knows what he's doing. But I know for a fact, inevitably, there will be people out there and they're going to say, like, ah, this is bullshit. Ah, I don't believe in that. No, oh, that never happens, you know?
Well, you're not making it for them.
No, it's right. True. And I mean, you can't deny, when you put on your favorite, one of your favorite records, and you sit, and the way that makes you feel, if you don't feel that, then fine. But there are some bands out there, and you listen to certain songs, and the way that it makes you feel is like, it's extraordinary, and it reminds you to really kind of clock what the hell's happening in terms of just living this life. And if you can't, if you refuse to let that happen to you, then yeah, I don't know. But there is there's definitely a community out there of people who live and die for that kind of feeling.
Listening to you talk like this, it kind of, I don't know, it gives me great hope for the future of
insane asylums.
Of insane asylums and no, but you know, it's clear that you were raised in a household that put a value on, you know, using your own mind, staving off your own boredom, and feeling like you don't have enough time rather than feeling like you have too much time.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, I mean, I sort of, when I read that quote about being excited by twisting in the winds of fate, it seems like you still are.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, certainly I've found more grounding now, and I've had some, if you want to call them, epiphanies or great realizations. And perhaps those haven't come easy, that you've got to find truth through error, whatever error means to you in your own life. But I've certainly found kind of, I think I've started to really understand why I really want to do this, and the types of people that you want to do it with, if you're lucky.
Right.
But it's the same as any of us living our lives. You kind of, you wake up one morning and your bones are just heavier with the person that you've sort of become, right? You can't really deny that anymore. You can't say yes to things that a few years ago you may have said yes to, because you just can't do it anymore.
It doesn't fit you anymore.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, it must be funny to have discovered something so young that still completely sustains you. Like, I think a lot of people, they don't have the parents that let them sort of explore and discover. And so they go off to college and they're told to declare a major, and then they're told to get an internship, and then they're told that the next step is to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe they never ask the question.
Totally. And I think it's a very, it's also funny, isn't it? Because whatever age you are, you always think you're sort of just cripplingly old, and right. Everyone else is really young and got it all ahead of them. But it's obviously, in like 10 years time, I'll look back and be like, what are you talking about? You knew nothing, you idiot. But you have to embrace whatever age you are and whatever you've learned, and all those times when, I mean, was it, I think my dad was just like, there's never enough time. It was something to do with, I was trying to finish something. He was like, there's never enough time. There'll never be enough time. And I just remember thinking, like, whoa, you just said something while you were, like, chopping an onion that's now going to stay with me for the rest of my life.
How old were you?
Oh, I must have been probably about 12 or something, doing homework.
So funny. You know, I think of that all the time, and I think, what am I doing wrong as a parent that there's never enough time? But yeah. I think that if there was enough time, I'd be doing something wrong.
Exactly. Right? I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's like you're never allowed to. And so in that way, you kind of, you can procrastinate and you think about all these things you want to do. And that's very important, to have a romantic kind of, have these like fantastical ideas of what you could be doing, because we need those kind of dreams and that imagination. But it's also about, okay, let's give it a shot. The worst someone can say is no. And so you try and go forward that way. But
well, there's never enough time. I mean, this conversation, I feel like it's just started, and it's
about so many different things, like,
and we're out of time.
Rubik's cube.
But I really look forward to seeing what you do in the future, because I think you're a restless artist that's making original choices, and just even from the last 2 years of your work, you know, I feel like you're going to make unexpected choices, and God, you just have your whole career in front of you, and it's really impressive.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to getting to know you more.
Yeah, me too.
All right, well, we'll do that.
We'll do it. Without cameras, it'll be great.
Are there cameras in there?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. La-di-da.
La-di-da.
Yeah.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, comedian, and cruise ship entertainer Thomas Middleditch.
I was pretty sensitive as a kid, so easily made fun of. That made me into kind of a really secret sad guy. I think comedy is the outlet. It's a way of dealing with it. It's a way of like looking at me like, how absurd all of this is. Life, let's make fun of it.
If you've spent any time in front of a television in the last 3 years, you've seen Middleditch playing the awkward, shy, nervous, tech geek genius Richard Hendricks on HBO's wildly successful show, Silicon Valley. But what you might not know is that before he became Mike Judge's startup muse, he cut his teeth in the Chicago improv scene, and then subsequently on cruise ships, and finally on the internet, where he created a McDonald's Chicken McNuggets rap that went viral and changed the course of his career. See you next time, off camera.